Right, be quiet.
That was a bird?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so cute! I have a birdie too, and he's talking to him, so.
Yes, I have an African gray.
Oh, they're the best. They're so sweet.
I didn't realize anybody else was on.
Oh no, that's okay. I was like, wait a second, what is this noise? And then I was like, oh, it's Trudy.
My dog is running all over the room looking for the bird.
Oh, this is great.
Well, my name is Mark, by the way.
Hi, Mark. I'm Diana.
Hi, Mark and Diana. I'm Carol.
Hi, Carol.
Oh, hello, Diana and Carol.
Hi, everybody. This is Michael.
Hey,
Michael.
Michael.
I wonder if we can get Dave to connect all of us at the end. Yeah.
I have a quick question. Did anybody have a chance to listen to the recording?
I listened to part of it.
I was asking because I did listen, but I had to turn everything off in my house because the sound was so low until it came back to unmute it, and then I could hear everything.
Oh, you mean so you couldn't hear Dave's?
I could, but I had to make sure there was no other noise anywhere else because his
right.
voice was so low. I'm going to ask him. Maybe it's a mic turn up on his end. I'm not sure.
Julie, sorry to interrupt.
Oh.
The gossip here. Welcome.
Hey, Dave. Sorry.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, I'm operating on a new headset. How is this volume? Okay, great. First of all, thank you all very much for all of your responsiveness. You've really brought it alive, and all the positive comments and the feedback I have, as well as the questions that you've had and the responses to the two questions I had initially, have really helped me shape this, hopefully, to something that's very useful to you. I've revised a bit of what I'm going to do for the final seminar here based on some of your questions, and we're going to look at, you speak to outline, I operate from that outline. I get some background noise. I can go to lecture mode, but I like to keep it an open mic in the beginning. So if you'll mute *6, because some of the techno static and maybe just the noise, you're not hearing, but your microphone is picking up. And I still hear some, so if you'll go on mute *6 until you're ready to talk. So I'm incorporating some of the things that you've asked and hopefully have answered your questions. Any responses right now and remaining questions in addition to the ones you've sent to me and responded with? What's your take on where we are after three seminars and about to launch our fourth and final one? Any thoughts, questions, remaining things that you'd like to talk about before we move into the formal presentation part?
Dave, this is Michael.
Yeah, Michael, go ahead. And then we'll go back to whoever I did hear.
Excuse me, Diana. Going back to the three phases of a transition, the ending, the neutral zone, and the new beginning, I have a feel for what happens in the ending. And sort of in the neutral zone, where I get unclear is what's the difference between the neutral zone and the new beginning, or how do you know sort of when you're done with the neutral zone and you're getting into the new beginning, and what is the actual work that takes place in the new beginning?
Well, remember this, nothing is ever as clear as for the purpose of discussion. So those are simply ways to conceptualize a process, and it doesn't happen in sequence, and it's not alphabetical. It's not 1, 2, 3. So the kind of things that you're asking will really depend on the process for each client. Those are simply ways to have a conceptualization for us as coaches to listen to the story that's evolving and that's co-created so that we'll be able to facilitate it, because there are times we won't be clear, just as the client won't be clear, but it's just a way to think about it, to look at one way of understanding, and it's only one way of understanding. So it's not a lockstep sequence. It's not fitting into a container, except retrospectively. It's sort of like, think about it in this way, developing the developmental steps that we have in working with the client. Now, we can say the first developmental step is creating a working alliance so that we have a collaborative framework, and that means that ultimately we can get away with saying whatever needs to be said for a client to really know that it's not going to be taken personally or pejoratively or in any way critically, but just we're looking at this together and let's consider this. And the working alliance means we can get away with saying anything we need to say for the immense success of the client. And it's kind of the same way with that, Michael. So I wish I could give you a better idea of that, but those are conceptual developmental phases, and sometimes they only make sense in retrospect, but the usefulness may be to guide us in proceeding. Analogous to if we have a new client and we don't have yet a good feel of that working alliance, that we really, so we may want to more gingerly and collaboratively look together rather than just wham, going with what we believe, you know, a month or two from now would be very tolerated and save time and move ahead. So it's not as specific, it's just a concept. Does that make sense to you? Does that fit with your experience?
Yeah. Conceptually, I'm still struggling with what's the difference between the neutral zone. I mean, how long does somebody have to languish, and what is the transition that takes place? A lot of what you're talking about is going to happen in the beginning and the ending, and I see that. It's getting a bead on, you know, what is the work that's actually happening in the neutral zone to get out of that languishing. And then what is happening in the new beginning that, I mean, I understand that it's conceptual and it's going to be different, but still, I have to have, I mean, it would help me to have more concrete ideas about what actually happened.
Here's one way that I would put it collaboratively with a client with that question in terms of looking together. You'll always be able to tell the difference between dosing and timing and titrating and moving ahead versus avoidance or procrastination. That's the dynamic that we want to address with each client, especially in that transition process you're talking about, because languishing does not sound like progress. That does not sound like a dynamic event. That may mean that we need to engage the client to look at, are they delaying something? Because our two basic motivations, one is to avoid pain and the other is to seek pleasure. Is there some pain that's associated to proceeding that they're avoiding? That may be the coaching juncture that we look at that moment. But a client will always be able to tell and be able to answer, maybe even before us, when we collaboratively invite them or just affirm our belief that they'll know the difference between dosing and timing and titrating, which is the issue of each of the developmental phases, from avoiding or procrastinating. And that gives them the story and the ownership of that story absolutely to them to be able to discern that and to be able to tell the difference between the two and move into even more so the dosing and timing and titrating in a catalyzed way. So that's a real distinction wherever you are. And a client's going to be able to tell. And they're most likely to be honest about that. Because they know, they've been struggling with it, and they need a collaborative partner to look at that and to look at how they can move ahead and, you know, when it's time to move ahead, despite anxiety or trepidation, and to help reframe that as a step ahead and a move to progress and have that distinction that, remember we talked about, the brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. If you frame it as anxiety, you're gonna pull back. You're gonna, you know, head for cover or stall. If you interpret it as excitement, as validation that you're moving ahead and have a collaborative partner to do that, you'll be moving ahead. So I don't think that's gonna be an issue you'll have with the collaborative framework and working with the client.
Dave, this is Carol. Sorry.
Go ahead.
This is Carol. I would like to, first of all, that's a really excellent question. The question of when do you know you're in the neutral zone? And if I could, and I'm going to be very brief, but I want to use my own situation as an example of sort of vacillating between those zones, you know, the end and the neutral zone and, the new beginning. So, just real quickly, the week that I got my certification as a coach, I got a call from a family member that I'm very dear to, and she was diagnosed with a very aggressive and rare form of cancer. So, needless to say, that particular week, I'd gone to the ocean with my husband's ashes to take back my power and to take back my unconditional love and to direct that to myself and then to go forward with the new momentum of, you know, my life as a coach and all those things. Now, I know that I vacillated between the neutral zone and what was the end. I feel very comfortable about the end, meaning it was the end. It was very healthy for me, a good transition to a new beginning. But I really found myself looking for reasons not to move forward, as evidenced by the fact, Dave, that remember I signed up just recently for a course with you, a licensed specialty course with you.
Uh-huh.
I really had to address the issue of where I was, like where are you in this process? Why are you creating? Yes, this is a horrible thing. And what I found that I've been able to really utilize my coaching skills in ways that I hadn't even began to imagine would be so helpful in coaching my sister and for that matter in coaching my family. But I really I know that I am vacillating in the neutral zone and the new beginning stage, but I am trudging forward. I'm moving forward in it because it's what I want to do. So I hear what you're saying about that neutral piece, and you do know when you're in it, because I do know that I'm in it, but I'm also moving forward. I have a plan of action that I want to implement, and as I was reading through the materials for tonight's class, I saw the need to have a plan and to put that plan in motion and to kind of stay the course of the plan. And yes, you might get distracted, but you can still be on course. I'm sorry, I didn't mean
Thank
to take
you very much
more time than that, but
that.
I wanted to share
very,
that. Yes,
very meaningful, and I appreciate that very, very much. And
hey, Dave.
I hear the clarity, yes.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
this
go ahead.
Is Mark in New York.
Hey, welcome. How are you?
All righty, and thank you for answering my emails. I guess into what you said before, so where do I feel we're at after three sessions? I really, really enjoyed everything that we've learned because it's allowed me to become more dynamic as a coach with two clients in particular that we kept going in and out of the neutral zone. And what I've learned in these three sessions and the roadmap has allowed me to get them more focused and potentially stay more out of the neutral zone, because much like a quarterback, people who have multiple stories, you know, you get them out of one and write a new story with one, and then they're going back to another one that brings them back to the old one. And this has allowed me to, you know, be able to audible to where they're at a particular moment and get them refocused and back on track. So I just wanted to make
that's
that
great
comment.
That's a great way of conceptualizing it. Thank you for sharing that. Excellent. Yeah, I would love to just keep talking. I do feel an obligation to give you guys some more stuff. Now, if you feel confused and have more questions than you had at the beginning, then my job is done. So this is about opening things. And remember, as coaches, we're perturbators. We convert periods into commas. We ask for more and to go beyond, and the change is uncomfortable. So every step, when someone is progressing, is going to be new and different. It's not going to be comfortable. And sometimes things make sense only in retrospect. So I hear the work that each of you are doing on this, and I see it in the emails that I get. So I want to save some time at the end for discussion. So hold on to any other questions or comments you have. I have, based on some correspondence that I've received from you, I have a couple of little things at the end that are a bit different, little exercises that I want to do, just in the spirit of perturbation, I suppose. So hold on here. Okay, we're going to talk about the specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. And there are a number of things that I want to include, and this will be a kind of overview of some things. One thing is transition niche coaching, to think about the kind of things we've been talking about and the niche that you may apply it in your coaching business. Let me give you an example. Practicing professionals, healthcare, financial, legal, have in common they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise. Their expertise to solve special problems and give specific advice is backed by professional standards, by laws, by codes. But even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems and provide specialized advice, professionals probably have not been trained to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, to remove stress as an obstacle for their success, to pursue personal development as vigorously as they've pursued professional advancement, to convert maybe from work ethic to performance ethic, and to emotionally and strategically manage career transitions. They assumed, in most instances, they do one thing, the profession they trained for all their lives. Another genre, performance professionals, actors and professional athletes. The primary challenge these clients have often is self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success. And one example and application of that is retirement transitions for pro athletes. These are some things I've done and worked with clients and seen. Now, here's a lesson we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermaths. The points are the play immediately following, maybe a tense and hotly contested moment of play. Both the winner and the loser of these intense encounters tend to have a disruption in the order of things. The loser's frustrated, which may carry over into errors or trying too hard. And one of the greatest challenges, probably in my view, the greatest challenge is to deal with extreme success. So these are the kind of things that you may want to think about in terms of application of the coaching skills and development of experience that you've had. Success does not create an immunity to failure. a loss does not foreshadow lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. Tomorrow is still the next day. Your next career is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything you've done before, everything you've worked for. It will stand alone on its own. Every one of you who have moved into professional coaching know this experience. You've moved from another career or careers into the career of professional coaching. Additional people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of a transition are the ones whose process begins with a significant and abrupt loss, job, significant relationship, disability, or divorce. We heard Carol share her experience of a huge lifetime loss. A next career is the same thing. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is important in itself. Then this task becomes important as it affects all components of the situation. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce in the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management create challenges, such as making the business aspect of the divorce only about the business of divorce, not letting emotional factors derail logic and judgment. And studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. A place that I see this kind of resistance in coaching is the family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company founded 38 years ago to two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and most importantly, identity. So one example is I've done some retreats with a good buddy and a colleague called What's Next Exec for current business owners and CEOs who are within a year of retirement. They know beforehand, at least they do after the retreat that we do, is they're not going to be happy playing golf every day. That'll last about 2 months. So how do they make preparation for a next career, a next offering, or a next commitment, what they want to contribute? They've been surrounded and supported by perhaps a corporate structure, and their challenge may be analogous to those of you who move from a paid position to opening your own coaching practice. So you probably know some of what they're going through. They have not set or collected professional fees. That was new for some of you. They've never had to market their services, set up a PayPal account, establish a business name, or find somebody to do a website. So in this instance, in this illustration, retired is not an identity, it's the lack of one. So let's consider this. What do clients want from us? I'm wondering how much you've really conceptualized that. Now, some of you who have read the book that came out earlier this year, Engaging the Ineffable Toward Mindfulness and Meaning, those essays in there were created, some of them, for white papers for the coaches in my quarterly mentor group who have trained with me. So I got all kind of feedback and got great advice about that. And this is one of the questions that I addressed. The coach and client become co-authors of that new story and create a current meaning that allows the distinctness of the old versus new in an evolving new story. We are always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching the coach what it's like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that the coach can teach it back to her out loud. We have to be open to that learning and not let teaching the client our theories or our agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously bridge to the experience and system of meaning of each client. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. What our clients want from us as coaches, in my view, is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we can give it back to the client, its creator, as self-statement. Full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, a feeling, or a behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I got that from X-Files, but I'm sticking to it. I'm serious. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result. To see the hope camouflaged in the sometimes frustrating process. And to validate their intuition. To hope that the coach will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in this process. The architecture of trust silently forms while you talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's still like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Invention has been sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in an old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I am astonished that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and the most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. Most likely the most. I also remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process continuing in its influence throughout life. I have said to clients, I'm going to be your coach for life, though regular meetings will be necessary only for a short period of time. Consider intervals of quarterly or at least yearly updates that can be beneficial for both coach and client. Booster shots, witnessing a continued developmental journey at regular intervals. You don't have to have a problem to do that. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory or technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line is simply, does it work? Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it together. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. Hemingway captured this principle, I believe, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. As we nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, we wonder, sometimes out loud, how exactly are you taking care of yourself? I'll return to that in a minute. How are you honoring your needs and ideals, your relationships? Have you created something that now seems to be controlling you? Are you framing yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you daily find things to be grateful for, to celebrate? An ideal coaching creation, co-creation, is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. That little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, to celebrate. I've summarized, and this is in your outline, how to facilitate change in coaching. There are 12 caveats, 12 and counting. And so I've distilled the following principles that focus on facilitating change and transition within the coaching relationship. Each person's life story is created. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. That's the R and the O of roadmap. Two, understanding begins with examination of which storylines work and which do not. Then to assess the ones that don't work, the ones that do work need to be kept, possibly enhanced. That's the A of the roadmap. Three, knowing what to do is at least, let me start over here. Knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. This is the P of the beginning to plan. Five, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. So questions direct, clarify, illuminate, and sometimes story bust and challenge. Six, someone has to change an internal model of assumptions to sustain the new story. This is the P of the roadmap, that you have to evolve new identity, to reprogram new identity in order for change to sustain. Seven, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. So, learn to recognize your own assumptions and beliefs, how they color what's perceived. Assumptions manifest as beliefs and behaviors and feelings. Making assumptions explicit allows us to see which ones facilitate and which ones interfere. Eight, change is constant and inevitable. It's resistance to change that generates most problems. And a kind of corollary, if someone is protesting change, they've already engaged it. They're in the process of it already. Nine, small changes lead to big changes. And this is something that we know and do regularly in coaching. So, for example, professionals get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get really simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively within the next day. This focus on a specific action of shrinking the change exercises effectiveness, and it also initiates a model of mastery that the client downloads. 10. Solutions, causes, and problems are not always related or even interconnected. The therapist attunes to problems, conflict, and development for process to occur. Coaching uses this space to focus on creating a new story, to align needs and ideals, to strategize toward the client's goal. 11. A collaboration keeps both individuals on the same side, looking at the scene together. And this is the essence of conversational intelligence and what we know now from neuroscience, that the first few words of a conversation boot up the entire neurochemical system that will process the remainder of the conversation. If those words are ones of collaboration, it boots up the system mediated by oxytocin, the neurochemical system of bonding and connection. Empathic resonance generates feeling understood. Then you can make more powerful coaching interventions. Also, validation of what's possible will have several times the effect of focus on the negative. 12. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. Again, don't be afraid to be simple. A physician client who's completed the 26th grade may have forgotten how to talk simply. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated and internalized, and it will be how they work with their clients, their patients, their collaborators. Now, I want to mention something, and this is more for each of you. If you consider working it into working with clients, that's great. But this is about life transitions. I want to talk about your wellness story. A significant aspect of a change and transition process is to incorporate a wellness story as part of that. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew from the beginning you were going to choose one car, you were going to have it for all of your life. You would do research to know the best car, and the best care for that car, probably to change the oil more frequently, to do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is actually a system of energy. It's an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So it consistently must be assessed. It's not something you begin to plan at age 65 or even at age 50, but it's choices you make each day that write your wellness story. Here's an illustration of little choices. If you plan to do 30 minutes on the treadmill but get off after 10, convinced you're a bit stiff, it's a small choice, no big deal. Nobody's had a heart attack because of 20 minutes less on the treadmill. You resolve to cut empty calories but then grab a couple of peanut M&Ms from the candy bowl, not really thinking about the choice because no single M&M, not even five, causes anybody to have diabetes. Take in 100 calories more each day than you burn, and in 1 year you gain 9 pounds. Our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify to oblivion. We are in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. This has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. So, here's a specific illustration. The story we engage with our bodies is one of two possibilities based on wellness researchers. decay, or growth. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., who wrote a book called Younger Next Year and a companion book, Younger Next Year for Women, says that 70% of aging is not aging but decay. If we assume that ailments and deterioration are a normal part of growing old and that we diminish activity and deteriorate physically as well as quality of life, the change at the cellular level will be decay. Inactivity and the absence of signals to grow result in brain and body decay. Another story is that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. This alternate story is growth. We send signals to our bodies of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, and zest for living. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. A new wellness story may include a central storyline of exercise. No negotiations, no excuses, but serious exercise. According to Dr. Lodge, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of your life is mandatory, and that 4 of those 6 days need to be serious aerobic exercise. I was fortunate to share a venue with Lodge and became familiar with his work and got to know him. I converted from working out 3 to 4 times a week to 6 days a week. It has made a huge difference. It's added to the longevity and the quality of my life. I would recommend that book. So biologically, your body only knows 2 things, growth or decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and each bathe cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels, and it's wounded blood vessels that kill you. Mortality falls with exercise. There was a broad number of several thousand people surveyed, and 3 things stood out above all others as things that prompted procrastination or were just simply avoided by people. More than anything else, people put off exercise, nutritional plan, retirement plan. Short-term desires trump long-term goals, and emotions can rule. So these are just some things to think about. And one way to think about it is if you treat a task such as exercise with the same mindset of work, you don't have to find time each day. You don't have to do it when you have time. If you do it like work, when you get up and go to work each day, you don't debate about whether you will or won't. You don't bargain with yourself and put it off until next Tuesday and say, well, I'm going to really get with it on Tuesday. Or feel virtuous if you do. You just get up and go to work. It's part of what you do. You don't have to use any energy to debate. Same with working out. If you work out, if you schedule, you know, at 2 o'clock each day, you guys know where I'm going to be. I'm going to be at LA Fitness. I'm going to be working out and end up on the Stairmaster. You know, I realized when, I think we have time for this story. I realized when I went to college, the first couple of classes I had were at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I would hear guys around me grinching about getting up for an 8 o'clock or a 9 o'clock class, and how much energy they were using and really griping about the client. At that point, I realized a gratitude that I had that I never realized was a gratitude, that growing up on a farm, I got up every morning before the sun came up, fed cattle 7 days a week, morning and evening. They were hungry. It wasn't something I debated or did. And I became grateful for recognizing that it was just part of what I did. I spent no energy doing that. So that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about when you, and this is the kind of thing that Lodge suggested, when you put it as part of your schedule, it's just part of what you do. You schedule things around it, and except for an emergency or a crisis, you're there each day. So here's an application. Now, as a mentor coach, you're not a personal trainer. You're not a dietitian. You're not giving directives. But you can make informed questions and recommendations, and you can even listen to how your client takes information and makes choices. For example, a simple question that I'll ask is, what do you do to take care of yourself in working out? And I'll listen for that. Now, here's what we know. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, the making of new brain cells: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is intellectual and emotional stimulation that creates more complex brain structure. The hippocampus is part of the brain especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And a couple of recent studies that are non-invasive in humans, in London taxicab drivers and the University of Hamburg medical students, replicated this finding. The number of cells in the hippocampus almost doubles with exercise. This is where the seat of creativity and memory resides. Now, another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis, especially in the hippocampus. The number of cells go the other direction. So this is something that is one of the things I think it's important. I wanted to add it here, even though you may not have been expecting this unless you looked ahead in the outline. Part of what we do, and this is something I want to add here. This came originally from Emily Pronin at Princeton did a study in which she found that people who could visualize their future self, they could create a fairly accurate vision of their future selves, as opposed to other groups of people who really didn't think about it or couldn't create that vision. Or just simply avoided it. The ones who could envision their future selves saved almost three times as much money as the ones who couldn't or didn't. And in very recent time, at Stanford, they've done computer-enhanced age progression to look at what people are going to look like if they work out five or six times a week versus if they gain a pound each year, or if they keep smoking or stop smoking, various things. So you can see the bifurcation in the age progression and the real difference it makes. This has a real impact on a lot of people. The same thing with the envisioning future self. People who were showed age progression up to 80 to 90, they began saving, on average, about 3.2% 3.2 times as much as people who did not have that, were not exposed to that. So, basically your story hides in plain sight. Think about the difference of people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. And by contrast, those who accomplish and believe have a different story or create a different story, and their lives embody that story for themselves and others. That's part of what you'll do as a mentor coach. Their story within, their plot guides them, orients them to the script they consciously write. So, through these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen, then transformed. We've discussed how to help people write the next chapters of their life and business story. So think about some of these questions just with an immediate response. If your story at this point would be published as a book, what would the title and subtitle be? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what will that be? And these may be things to come back to at a later time. Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. This is applying appreciative inquiry to your own story. because we go in the direction of the questions that we ask. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? What do you want to leave out or avoid as you move ahead? What events or process foreshadows your next success? What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? What is your spiritual essence? Remember, you don't have to be religious in order to have spiritual meaning, significance, and purpose. So I want to conclude by giving you some things to think about in somewhat different ways. To look at life stages of success. So this is moving beyond the wide-angle lens that we've considered things like change and transformation. We're moving to time-lapse photography now, okay? Success may mean different things at different points in adult life, maybe at each developmental stage. And I am a consummate collector of quotes because they can say so much that it would take me paragraphs to say. So I want to give you some quotes as responses. This is how it may look in a relationship. This is from Ruby D, I Dream a World. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's a way of looking at individual success. And this is from Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is hopefully dynamic and flexible. Once you achieve monetary success and professional privilege, you can figure out what's really important. Ideally, you've done this before, and you can do it sooner and better. A caveat, be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do, but frees you to do it. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective. This is from Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. So I want to do a final exercise with you guys. I'd like you to get very comfortable in your seat. Take a deep breath in for relaxation and breathe out any tension. Close your eyes and totally relax. Keeping your eyes closed, picture yourself at 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see now that you might have really seen now in present time, but didn't acknowledge? From 90 looking back, what do you feel about your present situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk that you should or shouldn't have taken. Keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face. Your hands. Your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. and that who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. Now, I'd like to do one more thing with you. Gradually open your eyes, and I'd suggest grab a pen and have a paper, because I'm going to ask you to write down the first thing that comes to your mind, the first word or phrase that comes to mind with this sentence, with this question, rather. And the reason is, if you don't have time to think about it, it's gonna be from your right brain, from your emotional midbrain. It's gonna be more meaningful than if you think about it and edit it. So do your first response. Start writing as soon as I ask. What is your unlived life? One more question, and then we'll come back for discussion. And again, write down the first thing that you think of. What is the one thing you don't understand about yourself? We're back in discussion mode. Any thoughts? Comments? I need a management of the background noise. Put yourself on mute if you're not ready to talk, because I'm going to have to go back on discussion mode if we can't manage the background. So *6 to mute until you're ready to ask a question. Thoughts or questions?
Dave, this is Carol. That was really great. Thank you for doing that. It's a really important exercise. So to your first response, I wrote that my unlived life is that as a successful author and mentor coach. And to your second question, what about me that I don't understand? And I wrote, I don't know.
Okay. When I first saw the power of that question, it was at the retreats that I mentioned earlier for immensely successful people, CEOs or business owners, and I had after 2.5 days, I had a number of people, in fact, the majority of the people who attended, who came to me and privately said, and some of them said in small groups, that question, what is your unlived life, was the most powerful thing that happened for this entire time together. And these are people who, by anyone's standards, externally at least, are remarkably successful in terms of everything that you could imagine, but yet they were astonished to look at what is their unlived life. Now, this is, to give you an example, this is one of the essays that I did in Engaging the Ineffable. I took the kind of things that we deal with every day in coaching and 21 different single word chapters. One is unlived. And look at that from different perspective, because so many of the things that we think we know what we're talking about, you know, nostalgia, mastery, desire, memory, we each have our own projection on it. Those are Rorschach terms. They mean different things to different people. So these are simply reflections to look at and consider as we develop our own self-reflection as coaches and help our clients do that too. Because that's one of the most powerful aspects of success that we can possibly do, is to be a catalyst for the self-reflection and awareness of clients. That will live on. That will be your legacy with each client for a professional lifetime. Questions or clarifications about anything we talked about? I know today was a bit different than what you may have expected, but I wanted to include some things that I think are important in this whole process and the topic of change and transition. Thoughts or questions?
David, it's Michael. When you're answering my first question, you used the phrase dosing, timing, and titration twice. Yeah. What does that mean?
It's I guess it's kind of a chemistry term. Whenever you decide how much you want to share with somebody or how much you want to expose them to, you want to dose it so that it can be metabolized. It's kind of the, what is it, the Goldilocks principle? Not too little, not too much, not too hot, not too cold. And time it so that you get a sense of, is this the right time to introduce this? Because you may introduce something that you feel is particularly useful, and the client just says, no, that's not right. So the first possibility is always, you're not right. You're wrong. Another possibility is that you're right, but it was ill-timed. It may be too much too soon, and somebody's not quite ready for that. And titration is simply to balance those aspects of what somebody can deal with and absorb and metabolize and move ahead. And that's what makes a process because you're doing it collaboratively. You're not telling somebody, it's back to, you know, what I said, that an ideal comment is to tell a client exactly what he or she already knows, and a little bit more. And here's the secret. That came from a mid-40s textbook on psychoanalysis. And the psychoanalyst said, an ideal interpretation in analysis is to tell the patient what the patient already knows and just a little bit more. And that's a good model of dosing and timing and titrating. So does that make sense now? Give it some context?
Yeah, that helps a lot. Thanks.
Yeah, great. All right, who else? What you got? Other questions, thoughts?
Well, yes, just a question. Sorry.
Sorry, I can't. The one to the left. No, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. This is Diana. Thanks. This is a quick one, and thank you. This is a lot of insight. And for those of you on the call, I'm a newbie. I'm learning how to coach. And my question for you was thank you for that. Lots of insight. I'm a scientist by training, so I really appreciate all of the background of fact behind what you're teaching. And is it possible for the folks that are on this call to get a list of who's in this course so that we can connect with each other?
No, that's not the deal. And this is what I would recommend anytime you do a teleconference or anything like this. You do not have the permission. Nobody's giving permission to send out emails. So I don't have permission to give out anybody's emails, so I can't do that. This is different than a training, for example. Because this is, you know, everybody's anonymous. You see when I send out an email, and this is what I'd recommend that you do for teleseminars, webinars, podcasts. I send an email. One easy way of doing it is to address it to myself and do a blind copy to everyone there so everybody gets the email, but there's nothing that's revealed. So that's why I'm not able to do that. So, sorry.
Okay. No, fair enough. Thank you.
Okay.
Just learning. Thank you.
Yeah.
Dave, just a quick question.
There was another question at the same time, and I didn't hear.
Yes, it's Carol. I just have a quick question, a takeaway question, actually. So if I were having taken this course.
Can you get a little bit closer to your microphone, a little bit louder?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Way better, yeah. Do that with your client.
Okay,
yeah,
terrific. Sorry, I was on the speaker. I forgot to turn it off. So my takeaway. So just everybody, you know, everybody's takeaway. But just if someone were to talk to me about coaching transitions. So I just want to make sure, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I just want to make sure that I understand it properly. So the actual change itself is the active process of going through the transformation. And the actual transition is, in fact, that transformation, and rather than and call it the new story, but the new identity. So whatever that is at the end of that change process, that is the transition. Is that correct, or do I not understand this way?
I would suggest now that you have gone through all four seminars to listen to that first seminar again, perhaps.
Okay.
And again, these distinctions are artificial, but yet they're still real. The change is I refer to as the event, and the transition, and the change can be external and internal. The transition is really a process, and it's more internally derived, and it's the whole process of the change making internally to arrive at a new place and to do that meaningfully.
Okay, hold on. I made some notes on that today.
As Michael, I just read something similar where they made the distinction. Change is like the events that happen to you. The transition is the adjustment that you make to those changes, which made sense.
Nice.
Yeah, adjustment and growth. And this is where we can benefit in mentor coaching with clients, is to ensure that it's a growth promoting and successful engagement for an outcome that may be even better than the client imagined, because we can imagine from our own system. So it may be even better than someone imagined. And you can't know exactly beforehand all that you'll see. So this is part of the engagement process.
Thank you.
I know we're over and I recognize that, but any other questions or comments before we wrap up? Well, I really appreciate your engagement, energy, and all the feedback. I hope this was helpful. If I can be of help to you in any way, let me know. You have my email address. If there's something that comes up that we didn't address, take a shot at sending me an email, and I'll respond to you. And if I can help you in any way, please let me know. Thanks so much. I enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the interaction with all of you.
Thank you,
bye.
Dave.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is everybody gone?